There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am, but Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hello and welcome to Curious Canadian History. I'm your host, David Boris. There are very few topics in Canadian history that have generated more acrimonious nationalist debate than that of the Avro Arrow. Some have called its cancellation a travesty that destroyed an entire Canadian industry. Many of those have laid the blame at the feet of the Americans. We built the most advanced airplane on the planet, and the Americans forced us to destroy it. Others, however, have approached the topic with a more circumspect eye, noting its exorbitant costs and the refusal of the Canadian government to pay for it. In the public consciousness, the Avro Arrow has spawned numerous articles, books, documentaries, and even a film. And yet it feels like this subject matter is still wholly misunderstood, and a clarification is desperately needed. This is Season 7, Episode 19, The Avro Arrow, Part 1. For this two-part series on the Avro Arrow, we needed someone to come in and do some heavy lifting. So we've brought in someone who's researched and written extensively on the subject. Russell Isinger is the registrar at the University of Saskatchewan. He is also a professional affiliate with the Department of Political Studies at the university. Russ did his graduate work on the controversial CF-105 Avro Arrow interceptor, one of the first researchers to access the declassified archival records on the project. Since then, Russ has continued his research and writing on the Arrow, usually in collaboration with his former graduate supervisor, Don Story. And they are currently working on a book delving into the political and military decision-making behind the project. I began our conversation by asking Russ, what were the roots of the Avro Arrow project?
Well, the roots really came out of that post-Second World War period. The early origins of the Cold War with the Soviet Union, and of course the atomic age, the dawn of the atomic age. So Canada, when it was in its post-war period, was sort of thinking about its defense needs, and with the threat of the Soviet Union and the explosion of the Soviet atomic bomb in 1949, really air defense of North America became a principal concern for both the Royal Canadian Air Force and the United States Air Force, who was their partners in the defense of North America. So the Air Force started thinking very seriously about what it needed for the air defense role. Fortunately for Canada, we had a fairly well-developed aircraft industry having participated in the Second World War. So the government of Canada created, sold two Crown corporations that they had created during the Second World War, Victory Aircraft Corporation in Malton, which is outside of Toronto, now the Pearson International Airport, and Turbo Research, which was engines. So these became Avro Aircraft and Arenda Engines, a private company. And they were tasked with the Royal Canadian Air Force with the first Canadian designed and built interceptor for the Royal Canadian Air Force, the CF-100 Canuck, which they developed and put into service by 1950. So the Canuck was a great aircraft. You know, we built 692 of them. No one really remembers it outside of aviation buffs, but it was a Canadian success story and a very effective interceptor. Two-seat, twin-engined, subsonic interceptor. And almost as soon as it had been, you know, designed and built and entered service, thinking started as to what the next generation of defense needed to look like. Because it's a time when technology was, especially aviation technology, was changing rapidly. If you think about the time period that the Arrow's in, you know, we were at war with Germany 10 years beforehand and flying piston engine fighter jets. And now we're flying supersonic jets within almost a decade. And the threat too was changing. So those initial Soviet bombers, which were propeller driven, the anticipation was they were going to change into jet and eventually supersonic, and that it needed another generation of aircraft to defend against it. So the Avro Arrow was, when it was, you know, thought about in the early 1950s, as the early design stages, was going to be this next generation supersonic interceptor. So two-seat, twin engine, particularly designed to Canadian requirements. Two-seat because it needed to carry its own radar fire control. We didn't have a lot of radar systems in Canada, so it needed to be sort of self-navigating and self able to you know, fire its own missiles independently. And so that required an operator to sit behind the pilot. Twin engine because we don't have a lot of bases. And as a safety feature, Canadian aircraft have generally been twin engine in case they lose an engine over the north. And supersonic because it needed to dash out in a straight line very, very fast when the radars warned that the bomber formations were approaching and get to its area and fire its missiles, which I will add were anticipated to be nuclear tipped missiles to destroy Soviet bomber formations. So the design was given to Avro Aircraft in 1952 after the RCIF had decided that there was nothing on the drawing boards or in production anywhere that was suitable for their requirements. And that became the Arrow, this large delta wing, very advanced requirements for the Air Force in the late, that they anticipated putting into service by like 1960, 61. So that's the origin story of it.
So it was this a government initiative thinking ahead, or was this a military initiative thinking ahead, like separating the politics from the military? Mm-hmm.
It's hard to differentiate the two. And the context at the time was that the military in Canada enjoyed a great deal of influence and I might often say control over the Canadian, their political masters, the Canadian government. Defense of North America was seen as the priority. So the RCIF enjoyed a privileged position in the defense budget because of that. It was a time when, you know, this is the period of the Korean War. There had been the largest peacetime increase in Canadian defense spending in our history in that period. It was taking up 50% of the federal budget, almost, defense spending, and the RCIF was taking up 50% of the defense spending. So the influence the RCIF had over the politicians was very impressive. It's almost the reverse of what was happening in the United States and United Kingdom at the time, where for obvious reasons, because of nuclear weapons, there was a emphasis on civilian control of the military. But the national security bureaucracy in Canada really enjoyed a deference, I think, to them. They had influence that they've never had since. So they tended to get what they wanted, and the politicians were, you know, could be forgiven that this was a pretty rarefied technical world, and it was also in a time where the danger was perceived to be real, like the threat of atomic devastation being rained down on North America was something that politicians think, well, they're saying we need this So we better believe them, because that's the risk, is the destruction of North America. So they tended to get what they wanted. So defense spending is always a combination of the military recommendations and the politicians evaluating. But at that time, the RCF tended to get what they wanted. It helped, I would say, that if you think about Canada in that immediate post-war period, we were enjoying quite the economic boom. Times were good. Canada had come out of the Second World War in an extremely strong position economically. Governments had money, and it's a sort of a truism in the defense world that as long as the funds are there, times are good. And the funds were there, especially in the buildup and during the Korean War period, for that there was a feeling we could finance this, that we could finance the needs of the military. It's when funds start to diminish that the questions start to be asked about what is needed for defense by politicians who get nervous about the costs, and by other services, because inter-service rivalry often arises as other services start to worry that they're not going to get their wish list of equipment if the other service does. And the RCF was a logical target for the other services, because when times were good, they got all the money. But when times were not good, it was obvious they were getting almost all the money. So there was a lot of nervousness about that later on in the 1950s. So it was a period of unprecedented influence for the military in Canada, I would say.
And so this was the administration of Louis Saint Laurent by this point, right? And so, and this is a pretty impressive period of spending. And I know that you and me both probably recognize that there's never been a spending period like this before in sort of Canadian defense spending. I mean, maybe besides the wars themselves. So one of the big things that I've read about the Arrow and that people have understood about the Arrow is that it was very expensive. But before we get to the cost, perhaps you can tell us what made it so unique. What you've talked about, two-seater and this navigation system, things like that, but maybe could you go into detail for our listeners about what made it so special and unique?
Sure. Well, it was very advanced, I have to say. And that has to be qualified, because I think leading edge or state of the art in technology always means the most advanced it is at that time. I find with the Arrow, and the fact that a myth has grown up with the Arrow, which I'm sure we'll talk about too, is it's often seen or believed by people to have been 10, 20, 30 years ahead of its time. And it wasn't that, but it certainly was the best technology that could be had at the time, and the most advanced thinking about the technology. So that's part of its uniqueness. The other uniqueness of it, of course, is it was Canadian. This is a designed in Canada aircraft engine, electronic system, and missile at the time. So it was actually has to be thought of as four systems being developed concurrently, as opposed to just one, because aircraft are a weapons system. And for a small middle power like Canada to be designing something that was so advanced is really an impressive achievement. And of course, that it was canceled takes away from the fact that it was an impressive achievement for a small country. Other things about the Arrow, I mean, it's a beautiful design. I don't think anyone would deny that the Arrow is an elegant, powerful aircraft. It was huge by the standards of aircraft at the time. So it's as large as a Lancaster bomber was in the Second World War. So it was a very big aircraft, partly because of the size of its engines needed to accelerate it to supersonic speeds and get it out. Also because of the size of its weapons bay, because it was one of the first aircraft to have an internal weapons bay that is pretty commonplace now. You see it on the F-35, but it was going to carry all of its missiles in this internal package. And that gave it a very clean, fast, aerodynamic design. And of course, it's a Delta. It's a Delta wing, which was a popular design for aircraft in the 1950s, less so now. And that was a design that was very amenable to interceptor aircraft, because people, I think, tend to think, when they think about the Arrow, I think in their mind, a lot of people have an idea of fighter jets as being like the Sopwith Camel or the Spitfire or the F-18, you know, mm-hmm. and they imagine, you know, a dogfighter, you know, someone that's going to get into the mix with other aircraft up close and personal. And the Arrow was not that. The Arrow was essentially a platform for carrying missiles at high speed out in a straight line to blast bombers. It was never designed to dogfight. Was never designed to carry bombs or to be multi-role in the way that aircraft today are. It had one purpose, shooting down Soviet bombers. And the design was very unique for that purpose to Canada. It, in some ways, it hurt us because, of course, that made there were very meant there were very limited sales opportunity for an aircraft like that for other countries, which did hurt the Arrow project later on, but it was peculiarly designed for our needs. And the RCAF, I would say that was very deliberate. The RCAF always wanted the very, very best of everything. So the Arrow represents an aircraft that was the very best of everything. Best design, the best electronics, the best missiles, the best engines. That's what the RCAF wanted. In some ways, in detrimental to their ultimate goal of getting it, because those things are costly. And even though the Arrow sort of extended sort of design philosophy in a lot of areas, they used a lot of titanium in it. The design itself was quite advanced. They had one of the first fly-by-wire systems that was going into an aircraft. It cut technology, moved technology forward in many, many areas, which gave the RCAF the aircraft that they wanted, but at a very, very big price.
Yeah, and that's so interesting. So I'm really interested in this idea of it being a sort of this mobile weapons platform, like, because, you know, I think a lot of our listeners and a lot of people think of Top Gun, right? You know, we think of fighter jets, yeah. You know, and the Arrow is not that. It is not Maverick. Not at all. So could you, if you don't mind, could you expand a little more on the, what you called it, the inboard weapon system?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the Arrow had a weapons pod, I guess, is a way to describe it. So it was designed for quick changeout. And essentially, the way it was formulated was the weapons bay, which ran most of the underside length of the aircraft, could be taken out in its entirety, almost like a magazine in a rifle could be taken out. And another one could be quickly rolled in and put in. And within that, missiles would snap out. So the doors would open, they'd snap out and be fired. It was designed to take a number of different kinds of missiles of the time. But the missile that they wanted, the RCAF wanted, was Sparrow. Sparrow is still an air-to-air missile that's in service and forces. But they wanted Sparrow 2. Sparrow 2 was a United States Navy missile, a new one that was quite advanced. And when the United States Navy decided not to continue to pursue its development, the Royal Canadian Air Force actually took over the project. So we ended up in the missile business as well. It could be argued that there may have been more conservative, safer paths to take in arming it, but that was the one they wanted. But it was also, they talked about unguided rockets at the first. The CF-100 Canuck carried unguided rockets. Falcon was another missile that they talked about, and Genie was another missile they talked about. And Genie is the one that was used on the follow-on, the Voodoo, the CF-100 that we got after the Arrow, which is just a gigantic atomic warhead missile. And that's the one really designed to bust bomber formations. All of these were intended to be carried inside this weapons bay, which was a fairly unique conception at the time, because most aircraft had their ordnance hung on the outside of it, which affected their flight characteristics and their speed. But speed was everything for the Arrow, which is why they wanted that clean design that the weapons bay gave them.
Curious Canadian history. We'll be back after the break.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hello, I'm Jess Milton. For 15 years, I produced The Vinyl Cafe with the late, great Stuart McLean. Every week, more than 2 million people tuned in to hear funny, fictional, feel-good stories about Dave and his family. We're excited to welcome you back to the warm and welcoming world of The Vinyl Cafe with our new podcast, Backstage at The Vinyl Cafe. Each week, we'll share 2 hilarious stories by Stuart, and for the first time ever, I'll tell you what it was like behind the scenes. Subscribe for free wherever you get your podcasts.
That's really fascinating, the way it's designed. So was this, like, from a technological perspective, was this the most advanced aircraft of the time?
It was certainly up there. You have to kind of compare it to other interceptors of the time. And like the contemporaries would be like the F-102 and the F-106 by Convair Products in the United States, the English Electric Lightning in Britain. So yes, it was considered to be probably the most advanced interceptor. Would it have remained that way had it gone into service? Probably not, because aircraft, as always, were developing and going forward. And in fact, one of the reasons why the United States, there were many reasons why the United States wasn't interested in purchasing the Arrow, but as it was explained to the Royal Canadian Air Force, to their frustration, that they had designs for an even more advanced interceptor that called the F-108 Rapier, which had not been envisioned in the initial years of the Arrow when the RCAF went out and looked around and saw as anything coming down the pipeline. So countries were always thinking about what the next generation would be, and the Arrow would have not been cutting edge for long. On the other hand, the times were changing too. So the need for a pure interceptor was changing as well. The question was starting to arise whether or not countries actually needed interceptors or whether missiles could do the job. Should aircraft be multi-role? And the Americans ended up canceling the Rapier, just as we canceled the Avro Arrow. They canceled it in 1959 as well, before it ever even got to the prototype stage. So it was always, the defense world was always shifting in terms of what you could afford, what you needed, how many of them you needed. So as advanced as the Arrow was, it was not, I would say, significantly more advanced than some of its competitors, and debatable as to whether or not having that extra level of technological sophistication actually got you a lot more. If the purpose was to carry a nuclear-tipped missile out and fire it, could not a cheaper and more do it more efficiently, a cheaper aircraft do it more efficiently, which is in a sense what we ended up doing in the end, is accepting a cheaper interceptor that did the same job after the Arrow. So it's debatable whether the quality was needed.
And you know, that's a great segue into the big question, right? You know, why was it canceled? And you've talked about the Rapier, you've talked about, but I'd love it if you just explore this a little more, you know, because we'll talk about this a little later on, but as we know, the cancellation of this Arrow is sort of this national moment. This is sort of like this pride in the country, and you're already identifying a lot of really interesting points. But maybe you could explore a little deeper. So why was it canceled?
Sure, and that's a complex story.
Take your time. With this.
Yeah, because I'm sitting in Saskatchewan. I certainly know, and your listeners will know, that the responsibility for the cancellation falls firmly on Prime Minister John Diefenbaker and that Conservative government, because, of course, they're the government that made the decision, and he tends to be the one who's personally vilified as the villain in this by people who believe that the aircraft should not have been canceled. That ignores a lot of the context, in that almost all of the decisions about the Arrow were made by the Liberal government of Saint Laurent. And in his defense, Diefenbaker did inherit this project in 1957 when he was elected, and then had to deal with it well after a lot of the decisions had been made about the aircraft that could not be undone, that sort of put it on its path. So when Diefenbaker inherited this and other thorny defense problems at the time, He had to weigh a number of things. And by 1958-59, both his government and the military had really run up against three issues that I would argue led directly to the cancellation. The first was how the international sort of strategic environment had shifted over the years from the time, in a short time, from 1952 when the Arrow was the design studies started, to 1958-59 when the decisions were being made about whether it should go forward or not. And the shifts had really come in a number of areas. So strategically, you know, there was a shift from defense to deterrence. So a real debate, strategic defense, about whether an active defense against attack was really worth the investment. And in fact, the United States Air Defense Command really was not as well funded and well equipped, although by our standards, they were very well equipped. But it was the Strategic Air Command that was well funded and well equipped, because the emphasis for the Americans was definitely about the credibility of the strike force. So deterrence would prevent the Russians from attacking, and deterrence, the plans of the Strategic Air Command should catch, hopefully catch a lot of the Soviet force on the ground, and an active defense really could be handled by the aircraft that we have. And even if, you know, if a few bombers got through, the level of destruction would be such that it does beg the point of, you know, why have a defense? For, because you're not going to have protracted warfare. So really the importance was deterrence, so that it never happens. So there was that strategic shift. There was the missile versus manned aircraft debate, which was really at its peak in this period of time. Countries were canceling aircraft programs. The British are probably a prime example, but the Americans did it too, because there was this feeling that the missile was going to, if not replace, I mean, certainly a number of pundits thought that it might totally replace the manned aircraft, it at least was going to supplant it. And the reality was, by 1959, that through, you know, U-2 spy flights and other intelligence and public pronouncements by the Soviet Union, we knew that the bomber force, the Soviet bomber force, was not going to be as significant as the missile force was. And the Avro had the unfortunate coincidence of being rolled out of its hangar for the first time on the day the Russians launched Sputnik into space. And that sort of drove home the fact that the technology was shifting rapidly to missiles. So it was a legitimate debate about what is better for defense. Is it a missile? What is better for attack? Is it an intercontinental ballistic missile? What should we be doing in terms of ballistic missile defense, which was a big debate in Canada as well. So that bomber versus missile, and for the historically minded people out there will know that there was a huge debate in the United States in the election campaigns, the early election campaigns, about a bomber gap. Now, was there a bomber gap forming between the United States and the Soviet Union? That shifted almost overnight with Sputnik to, is there a missile gap? You know, are we keeping up with the Soviets in terms of missiles? So that dramatically affected the need for the Arrow. From a strategic sense, because if there isn't as dramatic a bomber threat, why do you need the world's most advanced interceptor? Cannot something cheaper bought off the end of a U.S. assembly line do the same job? And shouldn't we be buying missiles like the Bomarc missile, which we eventually did bring into service in the RCAF? So that huge debate was going on strategically, and within the Royal Canadian Air Force, I have to say, it was going on too. There was you talk about inter-service rivalry with the other forces. There was an intra-service rivalry between officers who wanted the Arrow, or at least they wanted some form of manned interceptor, officers who wanted the missiles, and the RCAF was very enthusiastic about getting surface-to-air missiles like the Bomarc, and officers who served not in NORAD, which was as after 1957, the North American Air Defense arrangement that we struck with the Americans, but served in NATO in Europe, for which the Arrow was not acceptable. And the Arrow, what they needed was a different kind of aircraft for the nuclear strike reconnaissance role in Europe. And those officers were getting nervous that if the Arrow was purchased, they might not get their aircraft for Europe. So there's this whole strategic flux going on there within a diminishing defense budget. And that's the other part, the costs. It was a diminishing defense budget. So I would say the costs were more determinative. The strategic issues were there, but the money that it would have taken to finish the program was what eventually scuppered it. Because it was not that it was more expensive than a comparable aircraft program in another country. So I'm not saying it was twice as expensive, or, you know, it was as expensive as some of those programs. But it was the question whether a country like Canada could afford that versus a country like the United States or Britain or France. And that eventually became the question for the government as to, can we pay for this for such a small number of aircraft to justify setting up a production line? Because by 1959, we really only needed between maybe 100, 150 aircraft. Whereas in 1952, we were talking about 500 to 600 aircraft.
Wow.
So it had diminished to that extent. And why would you set up a production line for so few aircraft that are so costly? And if we went ahead with this, what other things are we not going to get? So the Army was getting nervous about, are we going to get new equipment? Are we going to get, they wanted to get into the missile business too. They wanted to have tactical nuclear weapons on the Honest John system. The Navy was getting worried they weren't going to get their frigates, they weren't going to get their patrol aircraft. So in that diminishing defense budget after the Korean War ended, the wish lists of all the services couldn't be met, and the Avro Arrow was the most obvious expensive item in the defense budget. So that cost was certainly the factor. And I'm going to throw in that it wasn't helped in either case on the strategy or on the money by the fact that the RCAF were poor project managers. Like, this was I argue, a very poorly run weapons acquisition project. They wanted nothing but the best. They wouldn't settle for anything but the best. They argued with the company, who was warning them presciently that the changes they were making, like asking to have their own missile system built and designed in Canada, the Sparrow asking to have their own electronic system built and designed in Canada, which was Astra, it was known, even asking to have their own engine designed and built in Canada, which Avro and Arenda were making. All of those things added costs, and the company was warning this, but they didn't want to hear that. They didn't manage the project in the sense they had no project management office until 1957. So there was poor idea of how much it would actually cost in the end. They were very resistant to actually evaluating the need for the aircraft. So the Army in particular in this time was actually quite savvy, and they used to ask really pressing questions at the Chiefs of Staff Committee meetings about, you know, have you talked to the Americans? Are you sure that this fits in the strategic context of what is needed? Is it a good idea to have such an advanced interceptor when a cheaper one might do? What is your overall strategy? And the truth of it was, the RCF's overall strategy was procurement. They were focused on getting a replacement aircraft for the Canuck. And they didn't really think about, you know, how does this actually fit into North America? Do the Americans actually want us to operate this aircraft? What should we be doing for defense? Would a slightly poorer aircraft technically do the same job? So the fact that the RCF had such overwhelming ambition, which I often call hubris, that they were proud. This was the golden age of the RCAF. They were the most powerful, the most elite. They had more personnel than the Army. They were not going to settle. And that commitment that they had to that idea drove the costs up and ignored a lot of the strategic shifts that were happening at the time. As one commentator said, which is always one of my favorite lines, James Ayers, that it was a force for which the sky was the environment, but not the limit. And there's a lot of truth to that, that they really could not settle for second best until they were forced to make hard choices. And the government was forced to make hard choices between what they wanted. And that by 1959, that decision was really made in 1958, and there was a lot of delay. The Diefenbaker government did temporize for the reasons, all the reasons that you would think of government would. They were worried about the international situation at the time, so they thought they'd keep it going as a hedge against something happening. But they were also worried about the impact on their political fortunes, on national prestige. So they'd kept it going probably longer than it should. But by 1959, pretty much everyone, including the Air Force, had agreed that the project couldn't go on. And the decision had to be made. And it was made in February 59.
That's an incredible context that you provided to this decision. Was the Diefenbaker administration reluctant to cancel it, or were they convinced by this point in February 59 that, like, yes, this had to happen?
Yeah, that's a very good question. The Diefenbaker administration, you know, had its pluses and its minuses. I will say, when they were elected in 1957, you have to remember they had a minority government, and they'd inherited the Arrow from the Liberals. That inherited a bunch of other problems. The economy was not as strong as it had been under the Liberals for the period after the war. It was starting to go into recession. So they had, and they'd been promised, they'd been elected on a promise of spending in other areas other than defense. So they were really looking for cost savings on the military side so that they could do other things. Things like support for farmers and increased pension payments. So this is also sort of the start of the welfare state in Canada, or at least the further development of the welfare state in Canada. So they had these budgetary problems, but they had a minority government, which they were very reluctant to put at risk. So the decision they made in 1957 when they came in was to not make a decision, which is a form of a decision. They decided to keep the program going. And of course, this was what the military advice was in 1957 for a year. And then they were going to review it again. The company sort of read what they wanted to from that, which was that the project was got a green light, and the military read what they wanted from that. When they were reelected, and there was a federal election in 1958, in which the Diefenbaker government won the largest electoral mandate in Canadian history, still is the largest one, 208 of 265 seats. So they had a massive mandate to basically do whatever they wanted to do. So they were politically clear, I guess I would say, at that point. And they came back and they revisited the program after their 1 year delay. And at that point, they became, I'd say, more horrified about the costs. They actually ordered a report to evaluate it and sort of convince them that it was as expensive as they thought it was. But it was still a difficult decision for that government. I mean, Diefenbaker, it's personalized. Canadians tend to personalize their politics. It's the Diefenbaker government, just as it's the, you know, was the Saint-Laurent government. You see the embodiment of the government in the leader. But it's really cabinet government in Canada. So the cabinet met on the Arrow innumerable times in 1958 to discuss what to do. And they talked about all the things you would imagine political leaders would talk about in the face of the problem they had. So how does this affect our sovereignty? How does this affect our relationship with the Americans? How does it, canceling the aircraft, I mean, how does this affect defense? How does this affect the economy if we went forward with it? How does it affect employment if we cancel it? So these discussions were quite intense, and I've read all the cabinet minutes on all these meetings. So they took it seriously, but they could not come to the conclusion that there was any other way forward other than canceling it within the environment they were in. And again, the military consensus had broken down, and so that the military themselves were in the end giving advice that it should be canceled. Where you want to criticize the Diefenbaker government is, I think, the time they took to make decisions. Could they have taken it in 1957? It would have been a brave political move for a minority government to do that, but they could have done that. And there's a lot of evidence that suggests the Liberals, if they'd been reelected, were going to do it too. We're going to cancel the aircraft. But they decided to delay. And then they decided to delay again in 1958. They canceled the Sparrow missile. They canceled the Astra electronic program on the basis that they could find cheaper off-the-shelf American alternatives. But they kept the program going for another 6 months where they were going to review it. And the finance minister at the time called it the most expensive unemployment relief measure in Canadian history. But there was an element of not really knowing what to do. They were worried about the international situation. There was a crisis in Formosa, which is now Taiwan, and islands of Komoi and Matsu. They were worried about the situation deteriorating. And they were worried about the impact it was going to have on the economy and on prestige and on pride. And so they delayed. I think they can be criticized for the temporizing of the delay, but not for the decision. And ultimately, there's a very interesting letter between Lester Pearson and C.D. Howe after they canceled it, where Lester Pearson, the leader of the opposition, the Liberal opposition, was asking Howe, who had been a minister in the government that had decided on the Arrow, he'd been Minister of Defense Production, how they should deal with the cancellation in the House. And it basically said, we don't criticize the decision, criticize how the decision was taken, because we would have made the same decision, but we would have made it faster, more decisively. So criticize how long the Diefenbaker government took, how they're framing it, the effect on the workforce, the economy, but don't criticize the actual decision, which is what the Liberals essentially did. So the Diefenbaker government is responsible in the sense they took the decision on the cancellation, but there's a whole lot of project history that led up to that blame should be apportioned, I think, on the Saint-Laurent government for letting it get to the stage it had been when the Diefenbaker government inherited it.
I want to thank you all for listening today. Don't forget, you can find me on Twitter at Doc Boris. That's at DocBorys. You can find us on Facebook. You can find us on Instagram. You can find us on Patreon. And you can find us on all podcast listening devices. And please do not hesitate to write and leave a comment. We love to hear from you. I'm David Boris. Stay curious, friends.